Welcome to Day Zero Update 4, May 26, 2024. I'm your host, Chris Elogi.
And I'm Brandon Perkins.
Yeah, two-man crew again, but we are, I guess, kind of in a shortage of stories.
Yeah.
It is pre-Summer Game Fest that's about a week and a half away.
Mm-hmm.
And probably have a Sony showcase happening here in the next week or so, right before it. So not really a ton of news. We got a few things here. Three acquisitions of varying levels of surprise. We have confirmation of what the new Call of Duty is. Confirmation that Ninja Theory might be secure from getting shut down for a little while longer.
Yeah.
As well as some other stuff going on. But before we get to that stuff, we'll talk about what we've been playing. And I will start here. Been playing some Senua's Saga Hellblade 2. Now that that is finally out, so that is on Game Pass on Xbox and PC, or you can buy it separately for, like, it's $49.99. So a little bit of a discount. It's not supposed to be super long, but I'm about 2 hours in so far. Been liking it a lot so far. It has a lengthy intro sort of telling you what happened in the first game. In case you have not played that for several years at this point. Which I remembered aspects of it, but not everything, and I don't think I beat it, so I don't know what the ultimate story point is, which seemed to be largely that she was doing all this to try to bring her lover back to life. And I believe by the end essentially realized, like, that was a futile quest to go on. Because it would require her killing herself to save the one she loved, and that was not a great idea in the end. Deciding to, I believe, like, live in his memory kind of thing. And so she decides that she is going to go back and free her people because the Northmen have shown up and killed entire villages and all that sort of thing. And so the game begins with her being on one of these slaver ships, going off to where the Northmen are from, try to get her revenge. And things start going poorly right away. The ship gets destroyed in a storm, and she manages to wash up on a beach and be very disoriented and, you know, fucked up for a good, like, 15, 20 minutes of game time as a... You're kind of getting the lay of the controls and all that, which so far has been pretty much fine. It's just it's a lot of slow stuff early on because she's kind of trying to get her physical self back in working order. So, you know, all that kind of fun stuff. But once she gets a weapon, she starts killing dudes left and right. Especially in very graphic ways of, like, sticking that sword, you know, into their, down their shoulders, into their guts inside, or through, through their hearts, through their sides around their armor, all that kind of fun stuff that she enjoys. And eventually kind of, you know, gets one of the slavers in a bad state and kind of keeps them alive for a bit to act as a guide of sorts around the area. Realizes that there's some other shit going on with the introduction of another group of enemies that might be somehow even worse than the slavers, the Northmen. And where I basically finished up playing was dealing with a whole big combat sequence with those people. As you kind of, instead of just facing one at a time, well, you're still kind of facing one at a time, but at that point you're kind of in this battlefield of sorts of enemies and good people or whatever, kind of getting pushed around a bunch. So you're taking out enemies and running into the next one, all that kind of stuff. By that point, you get a useful tool that is this mirror that essentially acts as a special meter that as it fills up from getting hits on the enemies, you do, you use it and you get to, like, slow down time and essentially do a bunch of attacks in quick succession and kind of finish off enemies pretty quickly. If you want, you could just try to go without it, but it seems like it's a very useful tool to make some of the tougher enemies easier to get, especially while you're still getting to handle the combat, which doesn't seem too different from what I recall of the original. It's a lot of dodging based combat, dodging attacks, all that kind of stuff. But they, you know, this being a game, two platforms, or like a, not two platforms, but almost two platforms, like going from PS4 and Xbox One to, you know, the Pro and the Xbox One X to the Xbox Series X and PS5 level kind of hardware.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty good upgrade over what was in the original, which kind of leads to some issues that you might expect, where it's hard to tell at times whether lots of rock formations are ones you can climb up or not. They don't throw like a ton of paint on that stuff. There's like some whitish kind of footholds or handholds you can grab onto, but it's not really super common kind of thing. Because from what I've seen so far, they have you do one big climbing sequence when you're very disoriented, but there hasn't been much past that. So I'm always looking around being like, well, is there anything else to, like this? And so far that hasn't been the case, but there's been ladders, explicit ladders, which you know, already know that that's a thing you can climb up, but the rock structure is like an Uncharted kind of game that's not been as much of a thing. But yeah, there's been some collectibles, usually in the form of finding these poles that have, you know, mysterious characters on them that are just telling you the order of stuff that you've unlocked and make it easy to know if you pass stuff. But the annoying thing there is that you're getting all this story information, you know, telepathically. But if you walk too far out of the range of it, it stops. And it's like, why not just keep playing it? There's already voices in her head saying things constantly because it's still got the whole psychosis thing going on, which is still a really cool effect. They're constantly, you know, hyping you up, talking shit about you, telling you to not do anything, that you're a loser, that you're going to do it, you're going to succeed, and you're going to die, and all this. And it's like, why don't you just throw that on top, give a little peace for a bit, maybe. But yeah, still a very cool game, but it's a very slow-paced kind of game. You spend a lot of time between combat encounters, like looking around these areas, seeing lots of grotesque shit that's been done. Animals that have been carved up by mysterious enemies and people chopped into bits and, you know, lots of body parts hanging up on sticks and all this kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's not a game for anybody that is the least bit squeamish, but they do have a good bit of accessibility options for you can have it handle defensive maneuvers in combat for you, or offensive maneuvers, or do both if you don't really want to do combat and kind of let it, I assume, just play itself out. But there's a good bit of stuff there, so definitely worth people checking out. If you want to see a game that's not going to really play anything too straight for you, it's going to make you work for everything. But yeah, there's no HUD, so oftentimes I would figure out if I was still in a cutscene or not by holding, you know, the left stick to the like the side, so I know as soon as she starts moving to the side that I have control, you know, that kind of stuff. It kind of goes in and out of pre-canned animation stuff fairly often, but you know, it's still first couple hours. Like I've seen like 5-6 hours quoted as how long it could be, so probably put some more time into it and hopefully try and finish it. But yeah, that game's pretty cool. Let's see. I got Paper Mario The Thousand Year Door for the Switch. The GameCube classic that not many people played because Nintendo did not make very many copies of it originally. And so I have not played the original version, so I don't necessarily know what is new or not. But I played a few hours of it, and it seems really cool so far. Very similar to what the original Paper Mario was doing in a lot of ways. They did not change things too much on that front, gameplay-wise. There is like a crowd element to it where you're doing your battles on a stage and you have a crowd that can throw helpful items to you, or you can find like bad guys in the crowd that you need to hit a button to take them out, and or else they'll throw rocks at you or something like that to damage you. But they have a lot of good explainer stuff. There's a character called the Combat Master that will explain many different topics about the combat and all the sort of menus and such to you if you need it. A lot of that kind of stuff to help explain things if you're not too sure about how everything works. But yeah, so far I've been enjoying a lot of good story stuff. I'm dealing with the dragon area, so kind of the first bit you get, because you know you do find the thousand year door pretty early, and then you see a bunch of empty star markers on it, so you're like, oh, I gotta go get all these stars, like what the first game was all about, which was getting a bunch of stars in these different parts of the world. So this seems to have a lot of that similar kind of structure to it. But yeah, kind of a lot of good humor to it. And so, yeah, that's been a fun time jumping into it. They've done a good job upgrading the visuals a bit from what I would guess, because there's a lot of a good shine on things, a lot of reflection type stuff that I'm going to guess probably wasn't done so much on the GameCube, but I could be wrong on that. But yeah, really cool game. And the last one I've checked out is Haunty. This is also on Game Pass, but I believe is also on PlayStation, Switch, and PC. So kind of went into this expecting kind of an adventure puzzle game, and it definitely is that, but it's also got action elements to it, as you kind of have this dual stick shooter control system to it, as you are this ghost that runs into this angel-looking creature that's called an Eternian. I'm not finding out more about what that means, but the angel kind of tries to take you up to heaven, I assume, is what was going on. There's no real dialogue in this part of the game. And these, you know, invisible chains sort of pull you back down as the angel's going up to heaven, being like, oh, you haven't earned your way into heaven yet, kind of thing. And then you kind of run into these other ghosts that do talk to you and, you know, have things to say to you. And they're kind of talking about how they don't like the Eternians, and that you kind of have to do some work down there if you want to go to, you know, wherever they went. So there's some elements of the afterlife in this, and along the way you are kind of doing a lot of puzzles, both explicit and kind of ones you kind of figure out on your own, to get these like star seeds or whatever they're called, that are all named after like the specific puzzle or, you know, little quest or mission thing you did. You get some basic ones that are like, oh, you do this checkpoint race that you just run with your character and dash through these rings that pop up, that kind of stuff, or collecting things, or talking to a character and like, oh, where's this person at? You know, so you go find them and bring them over, and it's like, oh, here you go, that kind of stuff. But cool aspect to this game is that it's based on a lot of light and dark mechanics. So have paths that are lit up, and if you go off the beaten path into the dark areas, the you start seeing progressively more like spooky faces showing up in the darkness that are gonna grab you if you stay too long. And I believe they have you do that early on as like a you know, so you can see the consequences of screwing around too much. So another part of the shooting mechanics, you can damage enemies with that, but if you shoot items that you can possess, you can sort of take control of them and do the thing that they do. So early on you run into like, oh, here's, you know, a tree that you can shake, and as you shake it, some of the bits that drop off will essentially light up random parts of the path. As long as it you know, drops in the dark parts, will light up more areas that you can hang out in. So yeah, if you're hanging out too much in the dark, you start seeing those faces, and you just need to get back into the lights to kind of go back to normal, kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that can allow you to kind of explore more off the beaten path, is taking control of those trees. That's kind of the main thing you're possessing, but you'll find, you know, statues you can knock over, or you do find other characters, like a dog that you can use to run around, or characters that shoot a bunch of stuff. Some of them control themselves automatically for you, so you don't necessarily have control of them, from what I've seen. But you do get some that does like a butt stomp kind of thing, so you can take out a bunch of enemies in close proximity to you. But your character can also shoot. And yeah, as you collect those sort of star seeds, you get to this thing that shows you, it's your upgrade mechanic is essentially showing you constellations. And you're planting those star seeds on the parts of the constellation to max it out. And that gives you a chance to upgrade one of three things. There's the meter for how many shots you can shoot. There's a meter for, I think, how long your dash is, or how many dashes you can do. And then one more for, I forget what the last one is. It might be health or something like that. But so I maxed out or added another bar for the shooting, because that makes it easier to, you know, take control of stuff. And you know, there's a lot of breakable objects and all that kind of stuff around as you're collecting different currencies. There's a leaf currency that you get to spend on specific upgrades. Some of which are just cosmetic, like here's hats you can wear, that kind of stuff. You have a triangle currency, that is the one that I think you can explicitly spend on cosmetic stuff. And then you have another currency that is what you use when you possess enemies, objects or creatures, whatever. As you do the thing that they let you do, it uses at least one of those. So there's an enemy that shoots stuff. It looks like their form of like the pea shooter from Plants vs. Zombies kind of thing. Like every shot is like at least one of those. It might be three, I forget. But the nice thing is those aren't like currencies that are, you know, in short supply to be, you know, like a survival horror thing, kind of keep that stuff hard to get. But because every time you go into an area, it respawns all that stuff, all those currencies. So the green light leaf might be have a specific amount in the areas. Mm-hmm. So I think it shows when I've been playing it in this first section of the game that there's like 72 max. So I think they are having a bunch hidden around. Mm-hmm. But the other ones all just respawn constantly when you leave and re-enter areas. So you're kind of encouraged to farm that stuff as much as you want, but you do not really need to. You also get health that drops off of a lot of things. So that's kind of feels like a Zelda game mixed with like a more explicit puzzle game. Because some of the puzzle stuff kind of feels like some of the Korok puzzles in Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom kind of stuff. Just you notice the thing, like, oh, I can light up these like lanterns. What happens if I light them all up? It's like you'll probably get some currency out of it, and it might light up a new path you can go in, that kind of stuff. You know, there are lots of different little puzzles, and that's kind of what the star seeds are kind of all about. Those are rewards for doing explicit quests and puzzles that you figure out on your own, that kind of stuff. And yeah, they do have, in kind of a Zelda style, you have paths between areas, though it looks like a thing that just shoots you around. So you have like an overworld map to show you where they all go, but they have not unlocked fast travel yet. So I've been thinking about going back to some of these and like looking for more of these seeds so I can do some more upgrade stuff. So yeah, it's really cool. It's a really cool kind of puzzle game, doing some stuff that's a bit different than what you expect. I'm trying to, and I think part of the constellation stuff is that's reawakening memories of your human life, that kind of stuff. And there's like one about you doing a, like, you know, the folding paper, like boats kind of thing that kids would do.
Oh, yeah.
You do that in class and the teacher like grabs it and rips it up, just being an asshole. And you go home to tell your parents and you're like, oh, let's do that then. Like, have fun, like, reward the kid for doing that. It's like, yeah, that's pretty nice. So, if you know, learning more about what your character did as a human and like how that's leads to what sort of, you know, learning more about what the life is that they had. So, but yeah, it's a really cool little game. Definitely worth checking out if you like these kind of neat little puzzle games that, especially one that's doing things that are influenced by other games, but doing its own spin on it in ways that you don't necessarily expect. So, but yeah, definitely going to play some more of that. So that's been pretty much what I've been playing. So how about you, Brandon? What have you been doing?
Well, as for me, I have essentially been sort of dividing my playtime first with an old, with, I say old, it's only been around a few years, sort of kind of sort of point and click adventure game called 2064 Read Only Memories. It's a game that came out, I think, around 2016, 2017. And it's basically sort of in the vein of like some of the older games like Snatcher or Police Knots, or even some of like the old games like, you know, The Girl Who Shot at Love at the Heart of the World, that type of thing. Basically one of those like old sci-fi visual novel adventure games. And it, especially Snatcher, it takes a lot of inspiration from Snatcher, but it's very much more modern in its approach. But essentially, it's a story about a guy. You play an individual who works as like a freelance reporter or journalist or whatever, who lives in Neo San Francisco in the year 2064, which is basically around a time when, among other things, both cybernetics and casual gene therapy have sort of become regular consumer goods and products. So you've got a lot of people who go around with cybernetic parts and enhancements. And at the same time, you've also got a lot of people who get gene therapy to alter their physical appearance. So you've got a lot of people called hybrids walking around. And in this case, hybrids kind of sort of work as sort of like an analogy to like the trans community. And for the record, the game and the creators are very queer friendly, so it's on purpose. And because of that, there's like also this backlash with this organization called the Human Revolution, which is led by a dude who's voiced by Jim Sterling. So yeah. And essentially what happens is one day one of these ROMs, which is this universe's version for a sort of semi-artificial intelligent robot or android or whatever, shows up in your room, finding out that your next door neighbor, this guy named Hayden, who you're friends with, has gone missing. And eventually what happens is it unveils this whole thing about like this weird conspiracy with like his former employer, this whole thing about, you know, unleashing artificial intelligence through the mesh net, which is their version of the internet, and all the sort of political shenanigans and stuff like that. Also, as well as like the sort of common cyberpunk tropes, like, you know, the police being a privately owned by the major corporation in the city, you know, stuff like that. It's actually really good, very well done, well illustrated, voice acted. It's not terribly complicated, like it's fairly easy to get through, but it does have a lot of like extraneous things that you have to actively look for or you might end up missing them, you know, different branches pass and characters you might not otherwise encounter. Part of the reason I'm playing this is because the sequel recently came out and I really want to play that, so I'm trying to get through this first. But after that, on top of that, I also went and downloaded another Crab's Treasure, which is, I think, going to be like one of those sleeper hits. I think it's essentially somebody, it's sort of like, what if like old school Rare decided to do a Soulsborne type game? And that's essentially what this is. It has all the, you know, the shine and cartooniness of like a classic Rare game, like, you know, Banjo-Kazooie or what have you. But at the same time, you know, I mean, it has like stuff like, it's got the silly characters, the British accents, the, you know, the the comedy and the platforming and the incredible level design that's all cartoony and colorful. But at its heart, it is still a Soulsborne game, which means that in spite of its imagery, it can get surprisingly really dark. And essentially what it is you're playing this little hermit crab named Krill, who's just sort of chilling on a beach somewhere, when this weird plastic shark thing suddenly shows up telling him, hey, you got a bunch of back taxes that you owe to the Duchess, and then basically just steals his shell from him. So more or less a bunch of the game is him going down into an ocean he's never really understood or knows what is, and trying to get his shell back. But as he goes through it, you start to realize a bunch of awful shit. Like, wow, the ocean is extremely polluted, and there is a lot of trash and garbage everywhere. In fact, you know, the whole game's, like, sort of economy runs on junk. The, like, big currency is, like, microplastics, which, you know... And stuff like that. And, like, that's the stuff that you use to, like, you know, get new equipment or increase or, you know, raise your stats and stuff like that. It has, like, all the sort of the standard type of stuff you would expect from a Soulsborne type game. Like, you've got a bonfire system. In this case, it's these enormous snail shells that you use to, like, both, you know, level up as well as sort of a way to... fast travel to other areas where you've encountered these shells. It's also a way to, obviously the standard thing of like, oh yeah, you could go here and it'll like redo your life and increase the health power-ups that you use, but at the same time, it'll also bring back all of the old enemies. It does have, and you know, it has that, its combat is heavily based around, you know, parrying and dodging, and even just a regular enemy can be a big deal if you're not careful. But it does have a couple of things that are different from like your standard Soulsborne. For one thing, there's the fact that because he's a hermit crab, that means that Krill can basically take things to use as like a surrogate shell. So things like bottle caps, soda cans, solo cups, old teacups, you know, jars, mason jars, stuff like that. And basically puts them on them. And all of them not only are, you know, have like their own durability. Some of them can get knocked out with a couple of hits. Some of them are incredibly durable. They also all have like their own effects that they can do if you use them. It's called the umami power. Which is, you know, measured by your quote-unquote MSG. It's a very obvious pun, but the point is, if you have it in there, you can use it to use these umami powers, and they can be everything from, you know, temporary power-up to, you know, electrocuting enemies, stuff like that. The second thing is the way that parrying in this game works. Most of these games like this, you have to hit guard at, like, the exact time like as the attack is about to hit you. Here, you do the exact opposite. You have to hold down guard and then let go of it the moment that the attack hits you. And this ends up doing two things. One is it sort of brings a new era of strategy into, you know, these surrogate shells that you use because, again, the durability. What it also does is it makes you kind of have to like go in between like, do I want to guard more or do I want to attack? Because much like with other Soulsborne games, your attacks, you know, have momentum behind them and you can't really stop that momentum once you've started attacking. But yeah, there's that. There's also just the world building. Like it's the game's obviously trying to go about like how, you know, the pollution in the ocean and how junked up it is. Like, there's just a bunch of... There really is just a lot of junk and trash everywhere in this game. Like, they've made cities and towns out of it. They have a holiday where, like, this patch of garbage goes over the city, and, like, everybody is scrambling to collect all the trash that they can that falls down in, you know, rains down on top of them. There's this guy named Rollin who's, like, set up a corporation where he's like doing like a scrap business that also is like a company town. And it's like the most junked up place in the entire area. So there's also this, you know, critique of capitalism and stuff and how it's affecting the oceans and all this other stuff. And just in general, for a Soulsborne game, it's extremely pleasant and like just feel good and fun to play. Not to say it can't get dark and scary. It definitely can. There's this thing called the gunk, which is this weird, like oily, slimy substance that ends up like corrupting people. Apparently it can bring back people from the dead and turn them into like zombies and stuff. And the reason I bring that is because a lot of the enemies, when you come across them, you'll notice their eyes are black. Crabs and enemies like that, their eyes turn black when they die. That's why if you've ever eaten crab at a restaurant and it like brings the whole thing to you, if the eye stalks are still there, the eyes are black. It's because they're dead. All of the enemy crabs you come across here in this game either have completely black eyes or their eyes are incredibly glowy because they're infected with microplastics. So once again comes this whole thing about you know, the microplastics coming back in. And also, unlike a lot of these Soulsborne games, the game gives you a lot of, like, what's the term? It gives you a lot of leeway and a lot of settings that you can use to set to make the game easier or harder as you want it. There's even a setting where you can straight up give Little Krill a gun. And basically, it's just like a Glock that sort of acts as like his surrogate shell, and it has infinite ammo and it can basically one hit kill anything that you aim it at. And if you think that somehow makes the game easier, only slightly, because you have to make sure that this thing is aimed in the general direction and these enemies can attack pretty fast. So yeah, but that's what I've been playing.
All right. So yeah, let's get to some news.
Mm-hmm.
We got a few things here with dates. First up, we got a new Picross game. Picross S Namco Legendary Edition has been announced. Mm-hmm. As Jupiter's announced a new, big publisher edition of one of their games with a lot of classic characters in it.
Mm-hmm.
That you are getting puzzles from, as you list here, like 30 classic Namco games that
mm-hmm.
half of these I don't really know. It's like Battle City, Dig Dug 1 and 2. Dragon Buster, Dragon Spirit, Final App, Galaga, Galaxian, Mappy Land, Mappy,
mm-hmm.
Metro Cross, Mystery Tower, Pac-Land, Pac-Man, mm-hmm. Rolling Thunder, Sangokushi, Chugen no Hasha, Shy Kid, Splatterhouse, Wanpaku, Graffiti, mm-hmm. Starluster, Super Zevious Mystery of Gump, The Adventure of Valkyrie, The Genji and the Heike Class,
mm-hmm.
The Quest of Ki, The Tower of Juraga, Wagonland 1, 2, and 3, Warp Man, Zevius, and Yokai Dochuki.
Mm-hmm.
It's like half of those are very Japanese-centric ones that
probably
got brought over, at least not officially outside of a collection, but looks like it's going to be a pretty cool game. Going to be out May 30th here, so I'm looking forward to getting this on the Switch.
Mm.
Give me more stuff to do on there, so that's cool.
Mm.
Yeah, and a bunch of screenshots of this stuff. It looks pretty cool, so
mm-hmm.
we'll see how that goes. As I mentioned, Summer Game Fest is coming up, and mm-hmm. we have another show that's going to be a part of that, the Devolver Direct 2024. Mm. As they describe here, we'll be celebrating Volvi's 15th birthday party,
mm.
a fucked up character they made for last year's show
mm-hmm.
that they claim has been around for all 15 years that Devolver has been.
Mm-hmm.
Which it wasn't, but they're going to be having that on June 7th after the main Summer Game Fest showcase is over, so about 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 5 p.m. Pacific, so that'll be fun to see what kind of lunacy they do.
Yeah.
I think it's supposed to be about a 30-minute show, so not too long. So there's that, and then we have a new game coming out June 11th, V Rising for the PS5. Mm-hmm. Just hit 1.0 on PC back in May 8th, I think it was. That mm-hmm. Luckily is not too much of a delay for the console version, so that's great. Mm-hmm. That'll be out on PS5.
Mm-hmm.
Pre-orders seem to be $40, I think. All pre-orders mm-hmm. get 5-day early access.
Yeah.
So that could be pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Unless that's exclusive to one of the more expensive editions, but I don't think so.
Mm.
Or no, that is for the two more expensive editions. The base game is just June 11th. Yeah, $40 for the base edition, $60 for the Legacy of Castlevania edition. That'll have that Castlevania premium pack in it. That I have to check what the Steam version is charging for that. And then they have a complete edition that includes the other DLC packs they've been putting out alongside that. So there you go for that. That is essentially an action RPG, like Diablo style thing. Mm-hmm. But with a whole survival game mechanic of building up your bases.
Yeah.
And that kind of stuff. So a little bit of a neat touch on that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there you go. That's cool.
Cool.
And that's all the dates we've got. Now we got, well, technically we got one more here.
Mm-hmm.
The Kingdom Hearts series is finally making its way over to Steam on June 13th. Mm. Except for one game. That is the... what is it? The rhythm game. I forget what that one's. Kingdom Hearts Melody of Memory
mm-hmm.
is still exclusive to the Epic Game Store on PC. Mm-hmm. I assume that'll make its way over at some point, but been a long time coming. Kingdom Hearts fans have at least described themselves as being tortured by this only being on Epic Game Store. So now it's finally coming to Steam with bundles for each of the packs, the 1.5 plus 2.5 remix, the 2.8 Final Chapter Prologue bundle, and then the Kingdom Hearts 3 plus Remind DLC bundle, as well as one that will be a bundle of everything. Mm-hmm. So, but those are probably all pretty decent prices for that stuff. Mm. But, you know, if that's too much for you, just wait. It'll go on sale.
Yeah.
Square Enix does not... they're not too stingy on sales. They're not like Ubisoft who will sell you anything a year old for like 80% off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, there you go. That's cool.
Yeah. They're, you know, I've got the 1.5 and 2.5 anthology on my PS5 if I ever want to play those games. Those games are kind of like my comfort games, weirdly enough.
Yeah.
Because like that first game, when you go into... you know, the crossover town or whatever. It's kind of like being in Disney World. You know, just that's just me.
Yeah.
Those games are fun, too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, there we go.
It'll be easier to play on Steam Deck. So that's the other benefit for people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, let's get to another game that's done very well on Steam, Helldivers 2.
Mm-hmm.
The studio behind that, Arrowhead Studios, has... announced their co-founder has basically admitted that he's probably not the right person to be running the company, at least as the CEO. So he has hired a new CEO to run the company. Who is it here? Let's see. Wait, where's the name of this guy? Yeah, former Paradox Interactive executive Shams Jorjani.
Mm-hmm.
To be its new CEO while he moves into a chief creative officer role, CCO, to help guide the creative aspects of the business and let this guy kind of run the company itself and kind of, you know, section off those responsibilities to somebody who's better suited for that stuff, so which is probably a smart move.
Yeah.
Because Arrowhead was probably fine with him at the helm for... the sort of successes they had before, but when you're selling 12 million copies in 3 months, you probably need somebody that can better guide the studio and its growth over the next few years as they continue working on this and maybe other stuff in the future.
Mm-hmm.
As they seem to want to grow into a much bigger company that will be able to do all the stuff that they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. That's cool for them.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's really cool. I kind of understand why they did this. In part, it's for, for image reasons, because of the whole fallout with Sony. And, the CEO is like, this isn't a good look. I'm going to go ahead and sort of step aside and let somebody else go in. I'll just move over here to the CCO. So, Yeah. So, yeah, it's partly an image thing, I think. And honestly, as far as like these smaller game studios go, Arrowhead's probably one of the better ones. So.
Yeah. So yeah, there you go for that. Speaking of studios hoping to get their next big hit, there is Ninja Theory that has kind of been working on Senua Saga Hellblade 2 for quite a while now. In the wake of the shutdown of Tango Gameworks and Arcane Austin, people are like, oh, Ninja Theory has to be the next one once they're done with Hellblade 2. And, seeing that they don't want to be caught with, nothing to work on. It seems like they have gotten a project approved by Microsoft to start working on something new. No real details on that, though they also apparently are also working on a project called Project Mara, a psychological horror game that I guess was technically announced a few years ago. But much like Hellblade 2, we haven't seen anything about this in a while, so that'll be interesting to know that they at least should have some more security for the foreseeable future. Not get the Hi-Fi Rush treatment of being a game that's critically lauded and beloved by the audience, and then that doesn't help them help save their jobs.
Because Ninja Theory deserves the respect that they get. Because they make genuinely good games, and I want them to be known for that. And I want them to be able to be given the space that they can experiment with games like with Hellblade. So, I'm glad they're at least still around.
But that could change at any point, because that's
Oh yeah,
how.
because that's how late stage capitalism works, and especially how the modern gaming industry works, at least in the AAA space.
At any point, Microsoft could need to get more money on the sheets and be like, all right, we'll shut these guys down. Who cares? We need the money that their salaries will put back into the sheets. So there you go. But speaking of something that's not going to be shut down by Xbox anytime soon, this is going to be a new Call of Duty game this year, as expected. It's been officially confirmed that it is Black Ops 6, which is kind of hilarious because there was nothing technically labeled Black Ops 4 or 5. Four, I think, was the one that didn't have a campaign.
Yeah, it was like a multiplayer only.
It was like focused on like zombies and all that stuff.
Yeah, the like closest thing it had to like story material were like these sort of these like multiplayer scenarios, and that was like about it, really.
And the one that was technically 5 was Black Ops Cold War, which I don't think anybody really liked, at least in the general community. Because that one just kind of came out and went away. People just played it and not talked about it. But this one seems to be the big one, and Microsoft admitted this as people figured out that like special direct after the Xbox showcase for Summer Game Fest is indeed for Call of Duty Black Ops 6, which is like, yeah, no, we figured that out from the pretty obvious art clues in there. And it seems like this is dealing with more conspiracy stuff, because I believe they had a big wraparound advertisement for the USA Today issue earlier this week that just showed blindfolds on the presidents on Mount Rushmore. Making it look like a big real thing, but I wonder how many people fell for that or not. But so yeah, we'll find out more about this. I assume it has, your typical kind of campaign stuff in it and all that. So yeah, that'll be interesting.
Honestly, the better, I'm kind of glad that they're going back to just sort of embracing the stupid shit. Because the thing about the Call of Duty series is They're fun when it's all about the action movie bullshit. When it tries to be too serious, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
But, you know, then again, you know, like considering just the response that the last Call of Duty had. Yeah, it's like, yeah, Activision kind of needs to like they need to retool the formula is what they need to do. You know, they need to stop doing this annual bullshit.
Yeah, maybe.
It
still sells really well, so there's not
that
much incentive to change anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I was seeing what the timeline stuff they're doing here. Since the last one was Cold War, this one's set in the first Gulf War.
Mm.
Of them doing Black Ops government stuff during the first Gulf War.
Yeah.
Which wasn't like a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a thing that was over fairly quick compared to like what just ended with the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to see what they do with that general premise, but it's also Call of Duty. There is the rumor swirling that it will be on Game Pass, so that would be the only way that I check it out. So, so that could be cool.
Yeah maybe.
Well, yeah, there you go for that. Then we got three acquisitions of increasing weirdness here. Atari bought Intellivision. This is 40-some years after they were both last relevant brands. And this does not include the Amico. There's a part of that deal that carves out the Amico out of this. And Television Entertainment will rebrand and continue developing and distributing the Amico game console with a license from Atari to distribute new versions of Intellivision games on the console. But yeah, Atari will also look to expand digital and physical distribution of legacy Intellivision games, potentially creating new games and exploring licensing opportunities. So yeah, they're kind of interested in adding more to their classic games lineup.
Yeah.
But the Intellivision brand, not a ton of like classic games that were, you know, got into the mainstream, but
not there
were
really.
A few that were probably more influential than you might think. There's a game on there called Shark Shark, which essentially got remade as a PopCap title. Feeding Frenzy, I think it is, essentially that same concept of being a small fish, eating other small fish till you grow into a bigger fish, and then you eat, you know, on fish on your level and below until you grow into a bigger one and all that kind of stuff, which now is just one of those bullshit mobile games that you see in ads all the time. So that's where that idea came from. Basically, that kind of stuff. I believe the Intellivision was also a very weird controller.
It was. It was like a combination of like an old school Atari controller, but with like a number pad as well.
It had like a disc analog stick kind of thing.
Yeah, and it also the games especially for that time period, the games could be shockingly complicated because they're a bunch of. The developers were like, well, we've got all these buttons. We got to find some way to use every single one of them in the game. So there'd be like these really complicated, like ship to ship combat simulators and shit like that. And it especially really makes it hard to like try and play these games, like say on an emulator or whatever, because although like, again, you've got to find some way to get all those buttons in use. So some of them, it's damn near impossible. Atari has Intellivision now. They now have one of their old competitors.
Yeah. And an interesting way that reminds me of, if you know how WWE has been, where they own a bunch of their various competitors' tape libraries. Which allows them to be like, oh, we have, you know, every match that's, you know, this wrestler has done up to the point they became a big WWE star, you know, that kind of stuff. Like the one big one they don't have at this point is TNA. That's because TNA is still around.
Yeah.
They rebranded and then rebranded back to TNA. Cause it was one of those things where it's like, it was originally meant to, in like the attitude era of the WWE, to be a reference to, you know, tits and ass. And then they're like, no, it means total nonstop action. And now they're like,
yeah, well, that doesn't make it any better.
Yeah. Or it's like, it doesn't mean that. It's like KFC, where they change what that means every once in a while. Depending on how much fried chicken is in vogue, I guess.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're building up their classic game library, and Intellivision at least got some interesting stuff in there, but yeah, Intellivision's big issue is remapping that for modern controllers. Doesn't really make a ton of sense for a lot of games. I think that was Intellivision was part of the game room for Xbox. That's like, yeah, this is kind of a nonsense thing to try to adapt to an Xbox controller. It makes a bit more sense on PC, but even then, the numpad does not necessarily fit what numbers you had on the Intellivision controller. So it's one of those things, like, this is kind of hard to remap by default. Like Jaguar games have the same issue because they have, you know, some normal buttons, and then there's this big fat like keypad in the middle of it for no reason, because they could, because that's what set them apart, I guess. And it's like, who the fuck needed this stupid looking controller?
Yeah.
Which meant that nobody ever bought it, really. So yeah. But I could see Atari kind of starting to invest more in buying out a lot of this stuff, you know, figuring out who owns ColecoVision's library, who owns, you know, that kind of stuff. They're not going to get the Activision library for Atari stuff, because that's Microsoft now. They're going to sit on it and do nothing with it. So, but yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
They probably will do some of that in their remake brand they've been doing lately, of taking classic Atari games and remaking them with high res visuals and all that, and kind of rethinking them for the modern era. That could work out pretty well for some of those Intellivision games. So yeah, there's your first acquisition. The second one, Nintendo acquired a company called Shiver Entertainment. If you've never heard of them before, it's not a huge surprise. They were mainly a port studio or a support studio that was owned by Embracer Group. So I imagine Nintendo got them for a pretty solid price. Here's, they have entered into an agreement with Embracer Group to acquire 100% of the outstanding shares of the Miami-based game developers Shiver Entertainment. As I say, Shiver is a video game development company that develops software for multiple platforms, including Nintendo Switch. Since its establishment in 2012, Shiver has partnered with publishers and developers through commissions for large-scale title developments. And recently has worked on porting and developing software titles such as Hogwarts Legacy and Mortal Kombat 1. Which Mortal Kombat 1 was a bad port initially on the Switch, but I believe they've worked on more of that, and it's a much better port now. Visually. And yeah, that's, so they, you know, they came to some prominence as like one of those studios that would get hired for those big those big budget port jobs for the Switch for games that probably would not have ever come over otherwise. But
yeah,
this seems like a strategy for Nintendo to be like, hey, we still want to encourage people to port their big games to our system, even if the audience is maybe not one that they would normally go after. So why don't we acquire this studio that has a lot of talent around this stuff and make that a core part of our business here, where we can work with these companies and be like, well, we have Shiver here that can facilitate the extra port work you need to do for, say, the next Switch. That might be a part of their development resources that they offer for some of these companies that don't usually work on Switch games. That seems like a solid purchase for them. So they don't have to bother any of their in-house developers on that stuff.
Yeah.
Unless it's an in-house thing. So yeah. That's a surprising one. And another studio that gets unembraced, so that's good. That's good for them.
Definitely.
And then the last one's probably the biggest acquisition of the week. The IGN Entertainment Company bought the Gamer Network of game sites that includes a bunch of sites you've probably heard of.
Mm-hmm.
That includes, yeah, Rock, Paper, Shotgun, VG247, Eurogamer, GameIndustry.biz, Dicebreaker, a bunch of sites. Because the original company that owned them, at least for this acquisition, was ReadPop. The people that do the PAX conventions and a number of other live event stuff. And so that it's weird that they bought this network of sites.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like the thing that's not being included in this is Eurogamer Expo and whatever the heck MCM is in this description here. Yeah, I'm not getting a summary for that, but I believe those are two big conventions in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So that I assume MCM is in Europe, but two big conventions outside of, you know, the stuff that ReadPop normally did. So they are keeping those. So that seems like probably what they were most interested in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so as part of this acquisition, a bunch of employees of these various sites have been laid off. Let's see, the GameIndustry.biz managing editor Brandon Sinclair has been laid off, as well as Rock Paper Shotgun's deputy editor Alice Bell has been let go, as well as a bunch of other people. So that's really sucks. Unfortunately, that's kind of part of these kind of acquisitions, is that they trim some of the extra cash off of there to make it more enticing. So hopefully that's the extent of layoffs as part of this. But as we know, with these bigger name sites, that's not a guarantee of anything.
Yeah, unfortunately.
And yeah, so that's inevitability that people will be let go at some point. But hopefully they do hire up some new people. But yeah, game industry losing somebody like Brendan Sinclair, who was a big name at GameSpot before moving over to game industry when he left GameSpot. It's been a big part of their journalism stuff there. So that's a big loss for them. And he's posted on his social media, "I've been laid off and need a new job. Maybe game journalism, maybe something else in games, maybe not games at all. Entertaining all possibilities at this point." So yeah. It seems to very much be like, "Well, I need a new job, but I'm not going to hold out that another position is going to open up in this line of work." So may end up going into maybe some community or editorial stuff on a publisher side or developer side, or maybe go somewhere else entirely. Who knows?
Yeah. Don't blame them.
So, yeah, there you go. Probably a bit more security for at least some of these people at these sites, but in the process they're losing a number of their associates. So that's the downside of that. So yeah, some sad news there as part of that acquisition. So yeah, you got anything to add, Brandon?
Only that it's like, it's just another example of just the game industry right now. We're in this like this era of consolidation where all the bigger companies are gobbling up all the tiny ones, and they're all getting bigger and bigger and more bloated. And it's just, it's like at some point the bottom's going to fall out. And, you know, I don't think it's going to be anything to the degree like what the gaming crash was in the 80s, but yeah, it's at some point it's, you know, the bubble will burst, and I don't know. I don't know what's going to come. But all I know is that when it does burst, we're going to see a bunch of these companies drop like flies, and it's not going to be pretty.
Yeah. Certainly going to involve a lot of layoffs and have a lot of people just competing for the same jobs.
Yeah, and it's going to be like in a smaller and smaller pool too, which, you know, that's going to make it even more difficult, because at the end of the day, it's going to be like you're basically applying for the job for all these jobs that are essentially all for like the same three or four companies. And, you know, that type of, like, hyper monopolization is never good for any industry.
Yeah.
So, you know. Well, yeah, that's about all I got.
Yep. So, yeah, I think that's going to end up doing it for the show this week.
Yep.
Went on a bit of a bummer, but we got some good times ahead as we have a new month coming up in June,
mm-hmm.
Which will have a lot of announcements here, at least. Teams will get to announce what they've been working on, announce dates,
mm-hmm.
At least have some positivity there.
Yep.
I'm looking at release dates right now, and yeah, not much this week. Multiverses is out on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
There's Umbra Claw from, I forget what studio that is, but mm-hmm. That's out on the 30th on Thursday, and the new F1 game is out on Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But as you said, new Picross game out this week, as well as some other stuff going on. So yeah, got some neat stuff here happening. Oh yeah, Star Wars Hunters is out.
Mm-hmm.
That's not technically this week. That's next Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
That's June 4th. Let me see what else. Yeah, The Rogue Prince of Persia. Yeah, is out this month.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's the 27th. So that's tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Coming out on Memorial Day in the U.S. You can definitely tell that a French publisher published that game.
Yep.
So yeah, mm-hmm. I don't think it. Yeah, so that's going to be fun to see. But yeah, we got some stuff coming out. But we get a little bit of a break from a bunch of new releases that have been coming out all month. So
mm-hmm.
At least we got some announcements coming up here in the next couple of weeks with Summer Game Fest for that weekend. There's a mm-hmm. bunch of shows happening there, as well as a bunch of indie shows. They're doing a lot of cool stuff there, so yeah, they're doing like a showcase for just women-led games, one from Latin American studios. Let's see, there's the Wholesome Direct, yeah, Latin American Games Showcase, Women-Led Games Summer Game Fest Showcase. So yeah, some neat like showcases for different markets that you don't necessarily get to see.
Yeah.
So yeah, that'll be cool. Yeah, next week we'll probably talk more about what to expect out of these showcases.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, until then, we'll let you all go. Thank you, Brandon, for joining this week.
Always.
We'll be back next week with a new slate of news and another week closer to Summer Game Fest.
Yeah.
And yeah, it is Summer Game Fest, not Summer Games Fest.
Yeah.
As there's been a thing going around, people pointing out how much of the media and even some of the companies in the showcase pronounce it wrong or write it down wrong. And it's like, yeah, probably some of that is the effect of the Olympics that gets pushed, with which are called the Summer Games. That is a common nomenclature, at least here in the U.S. But yeah, that'll be happening shortly. But yeah, if you enjoy the show, if you let friends and family know, they should check it out and select Strangers. That will also be looking forward to some teams being able to get to announce their games here in the next
and not getting, you know, absolutely shit canned by some major corporation that owns them.
Yeah.
Ugh.
So there's some bright stuff coming up. But yeah, thank you all for tuning in. Hope you have a good week ahead, and we'll see y'all next time. Have a good one.